Okay, I think we can go now. So, as I wrote here, I posted a new homework assignment due a week from Wednesday. Sorry, it's only one problem though. So I think that won't be too bad. Today I want to finish the discussion of chapter 8, and actually this discussion of the photon interpretation, I think, is not in Jackson. But sometimes when you talk about electromagnetic phenomena, it's interesting to kind of keep in mind that in the back of our minds that really we are talking about photons, try to express some of the quantities. What does it mean for a photon? And then we'll move into chapter 9 on radiation. So what this part of the trip, part of the material I call the photon interpretation of Q, and I'm going to imagine a waveguide, cylindrical kind of a waveguide with photons bouncing back and forth in this waveguide. Let's set up some geometry, length D of the cylinder, just a vacuum inside, and consider one particular photon moving back and forth, reflected from the walls with energy H bar omega naught, frequency omega naught. This is our photon. And so you could think this could be a laser cavity, for instance, although usually a laser cavity, I think, doesn't have cylindrical walls, but let's ignore that detail. So basically, the photon bounces back and forth. And let's say it has a probability script P to escape the cavity each time it hits the end caps. But the round part of the cylinder, let's imagine that's perfect conductor, and so no losses are going to be lost there. And this might correspond to the way you would want a laser to work, right? You'd want some of the photons, occasionally at least, to get out. But you might want to build up a lot of power inside by having a really effective lasing situation. So we can calculate the average energy loss per second will be capital P. That'll involve this probability for each collision with an end cap times the energy that would be lost if the photon is lost. And then we will divide by the time it takes to get from one end to another. So that is going to be I called that probability, I think maybe. No, this is the power, the rate of energy loss, per second, which will be the denominator of our Q. And, of course, the energy stored for this one photon in the cavity is just H bar omega naught. And so the Q in photon terms will be this ratio, which is omega naught H bar omega naught over P C over D H bar omega naught, or omega naught D over script P times C, which we can also interpret as 2 pi over the period of the electromagnetic oscillations, right? That's omega naught is 2 pi over the period times the transit time back and forth for one transit of the cavity divided by the probability of loss per time, loss per collision with the wall, with the end caps. And in fact, this quantity delta T over P can be viewed as basically the inverse of the rate of loss, right? P over delta T, that's the rate of loss. So 1 over it is the average lifetime, if you like, time for escape of the photon, which we might call also tau, because it's like a lifetime. So in fact, in that language, Q is actually quite simple. Can view it as 2 pi, the lifetime of photons in the cavity, over the period of the radiation oscillating in the cavity, capital T, which we can also think as 2 pi times the number of radiation cycles times the electric field goes up and down in the photon lifetime. Anyway, for me, this helps to make the concept of the Q more physical, to think of it this way. There are a couple other topics I'm not going to cover in depth, but I thought I'd mention. Section 8.9 is kind of interesting about the Schumann resonances. Of a very physical cavity that you can easily imagine. Take the Earth, let's say it's a sphere of radius A, the solid part of the Earth, and this can be viewed as a resonant cavity going out to the ionosphere, between the Earth and the ionosphere. It's an electromagnetic cavity. And so in this interior of this cavity, between the ionosphere and the solid Earth, you can derive the TE modes that should exist in such a cavity. And for a spherical cavity geometry like the text derives the mode frequencies have this dependence. For the Lth mode, should look like the speed of light over this radius A, square root of LL plus 1, the factor you normally expect to see in spherical geometries. And this works out to be something like, for these frequencies, omega 2 pi times like 8, 14, 20 hertz. And these are observed experimentally. Another topic I'm not going to cover, but you might read, especially if you're interested in optical fibers. 810 is about electromagnetic wave propagation in an optical fiber, where basically you have two different indices of refraction material, and they are chosen such that you have total internal reflection of a photon as it's going in this cavity off of this inner wall. And that's what keeps the radiation guided inside. Okay, I think that's all I wanted to say about chapter 8. All right, jiggling charges and currents and how they radiate. And this is a very general topic. It includes not only maybe what you would think of an antenna at a radio station sending out signals in the kilohertz or megahertz frequency range, or your Wi-Fi router, or a single atom or molecule. All of these can be radiating systems. And we'll think about some of these examples. So for now, I'm going to consider monochromatic sources and fields again, which helps simplify the math. And we know we can get from here to more complex time dependencies by Fourier analysis if we have to. So let's establish the math. Let's say we have charges changing in time with some spatial dependence, and a monochromatic e to the minus I omega t time dependence, and j of xt. The physical currents are the real part of j of x e to the minus I omega t. But we'll consider these complex fields since they obey simplest equations, and take the real parts later whenever we want something physically observable in nature. So let's work in the Lorentz cage, look at the wave equations. The Lorentz cage is usually the best one to use whenever you're talking about radiation phenomena. Del squared phi for the electric potential, minus 1 over c squared, d squared phi dt squared, is minus rho over epsilon naught, and del squared A, etc., d squared A dt squared is minus mu naught J. So the picture here is you're going to have these time-dependent currents and charges, and they are going to send out radiation into the wild blue yonder. How could we solve those? Well, you all know how to solve equations like that. We could do it with the Green's function, my favorite. In fact, I think maybe we already did this. in an earlier chapter, at least the setting it up without looking into all the details. A will be mu naught over 4 pi. Integral over our four-dimensional independent variables, which include 3 spatial and 1 time. We need the Green's function at an observation point and time, x and t, and at a source time, position and time, x prime and t prime, multiplying j of x prime t prime. That is a particular solution of that partial differential equation. It's not the most general solution, of course. Don't forget that there could be other fields present which are already solutions of the homogeneous equation. So we're going to have an antenna, oscillating current, sending out radiation that will represent its J in some way. But at the same time, A in some region where we are going to look, we're going to see an antenna radiating. But there's some other Wi-Fi router over here sending its signals too. And that's what I'm talking about here. I'm just talking about like solving for this radiation by this integral of this. But you have to add wherever, whatever other fields are coming. And that will be the total fields in that area. Of course, those might not be at the same frequency. So when we go to the monochromatic limit here, then you can usually forget about this homogeneous term, realize there will be fields from other sources you can measure or keep track of. Okay, so if we have no boundary surfaces, that's the easiest situation. We can just take the free space Green's function of the Helmholtz equation. Well, I should say of the wave equation. Let's start with that. And we want the retarded Green's function, right, which says if you have a source oscillating, then you'll feel a point source oscillating. Then at a later time, t greater than t prime, you feel the effects of it. We indicated it as g plus, I think, back in chapter 6. And it's astonishingly simple, a Dirac delta function, delta of t prime minus t minus r over c over r, where this r is the vector to the source, or to the observation point from the source point. And so t prime at the source is earlier than when the effects are observed at the observation point, earlier than the oscillating time at the source. Sorry, earlier than the time t at the observation point by this speed of light, r over c. So let's plug in our Green's function and go ahead and do this integral. It's mu naught over 4 pi. Integral d cubed x prime. Let's do the time integral first, the t prime integral first, and that is just very trivial. It evaluates j at x prime at the time t minus absolute x minus x prime over c over absolute x minus x prime. Okay, so now we will now introduce the monochromatic time dependence. J of xt is j of x, e to the minus I omega t, and so then we get, can factor out the e to the minus omega t, and that will multiply a purely spatial quantity, mu naught over 4 pi, integral d cubed x prime. Did I hear a yawn? Oh, I'm so discouraged. I'll try to be very much more lively. Just have that integral to do over the source times this exponential factor, which is like e to the ikr over r. And this quantity in parentheses is without time, so that's our a of x over there, is this quantity in parentheses. And similarly, of course, phi of x will be, the analysis is exactly in parallel, will become a spatial integral over the source, e to the ikr over r times the spatial part of the oscillating charge density. And one interesting thing about radiation fields is actually we only need, when we're interested in radiation coming out of such a source, we actually only need A, because A determines H, and from the H we can get E. So let me just quickly remind you how that works. Right. So H is 1 over mu naught curl of A. And curl of B is mu naught J plus 1 over C squared D E dt. And so for if we look in the regions where we're outside all the currents and charges, where J is 0, we'll just have minus I omega C squared for monochromatic time dependences is equal to mu naught curl of H. But this omega over C squared, right, that's also could be written CK over C squared, or K mu naught epsilon naught over square root mu naught epsilon naught, which leads to E of x for monochromatic fields. The spatial part is I times this z naught factor k z naught over k times the curl of h, where this z naught is sometimes called the impedance of free space. Is defined to be root mu naught over epsilon naught. Okay. So that means we don't have to solve two wave equations, we just have to solve one, although it has three components, which is a little annoying about vector fields. But that's reality. The main downside of this strategy is that this integral for a of x I wrote, have now erased, is can be difficult to evaluate for some complicated source. But there is a systematic approach, a strategy that is pretty successful, is to use a partial wave expansion. And this is given in equation 9.98. It's a really important equation, actually. You'll use it in quantum world often when you do scattering theory, for instance. It's a formula for the spatial part of the Green's function, e to the ikr over r. To break it down into separable terms, each term of which has a separate dependence on the x and x prime vectors, which is very helpful for doing those integrals over the source. Otherwise, this absolute x minus x prime that is in both the exponent and the denominator is quite annoying to try to integrate over for realistic sources. But if you have sum of separable terms, which I will now show, we'll sum over all partial waves L. As usual, there will be a radial part with the spherical Bessel function at r lesser, like we're used to seeing. For the smaller r parts, where r lesser is the smaller of r and r prime relative to some origin. And the outer part is the outgoing wave Hankel function, HL1 of kr greater. And then there's the usual sum over m from minus L to L we expect in spherical problems with spherical harmonics, YLM star of x hat prime, YLM of x hat. Again, these aren't x unit vectors, these are shorthand for theta prime, phi prime, and so on. So that's kind of a general strategy. You can always use that. But I'm going to actually start by treating some of the simplest limiting cases without using this big machinery of this full partial wave expansion with these lovely and enchanting spherical Bessel functions. But first, we ought to keep in our head, before we start looking at limits, what are the distance scales, length scales in the problem? And there are really three. And you might imagine we're going to see different limiting situations depending on which is large, which is small, and so on. So there's first of all D, I'll call D the physical size of our sources in the problem. It could be an atom, could be an antenna, your Wi-Fi router. It has a size. Then there is the wavelength of the radiation, 2 pi c over omega. For the waves that are going to be coming out. And then finally there is r, which is the observation distance. Which will usually be quite large compared to the other. But not always. So in fact, there are really three limits of interest, three cases. The first one is called the near zone. And in this is also sometimes called the static zone. In this region, you're looking at distances much less away from the source. Less than a wavelength, but still relatively far from the source size. There is an intermediate zone, or it's also sometimes referred to as the induction zone. Where again, you're pretty far outside the source size, but the distance you're at is of the order of lambda. And then, of course, there's the far zone, where you're many wavelengths away, also called the radiation zone. Where D is usually much less than the radiation wavelength, which in turn is much smaller than the observation point. Many wavelengths away is where you're looking at the fields. So let's start with the near zone first. Okay, D much less than R, much less than lambda. In the near zone, the exponential in our integral, right, which involves the size and the distance, this is approximately 1, right, because k is 1 over lambda, lambda is the biggest length scale. So in this limit, a of x is a very simple formula, which in fact we've seen before in chapter 5, mu naught over 4 pi integral of j of x prime d cubed x prime over the distance. This is the exact same integral we did in magnetostatics. Equation 5.32, if you're interested. And so in the near zone, A of x is exactly the same as you would have for a steady current source with no time dependence, just with an overall e to the minus I omega t time dependence, about as simple as you could hope for. And to do this integral, if it's hard, you could, for localized currents, you might still benefit from doing a multiple expansion. You can always plug in the multiple expansion of 1 over x minus x prime. You all remember that. Sum over L and M, R lesser to the L over R greater to the L plus 1, YLM star times YLM. One of my favorite formulas. The next case I'll look at is the far zone, which is, I would say, usually the most important when you're sending information or energy or both over large distances. So in the far zone, right, again, d much less than lambda, much less than r. And since in all of three of these zones, r is much greater than d, in all three cases, it can be useful to expand this in just binomial expansion. Like I say, you can always also use the general multiple expansion I wrote out to start with, but we can also do some a little more elementary examination just using the binomial expansion, which looks like this. And I guess sometimes I call these R prime and R when I'm just writing the magnitude. Reason for doing this is then we can also write it as r times 1 minus x vector over r dotted into x prime vector over r plus higher order terms. And another way to write that, which we'll find useful, actually frequently use this formula here for the absolute value of x minus x prime far away from the source, can approximate it as r for the one here minus the n hat vector dotted into the x prime vector. Right. So we have a coordinate system, looks something like this. We got some source, usually put your origin somewhere in the middle of the source. It has some vector x prime to various points in the source. And then there is a vector to an observation point far away, vector x, which is n hat times r, to some observation point p. That's the geometry we are talking about. So very far from the source, we can write our integral use this fact that R is much greater than D, so we can use this approximation. We have the mu naught over 4 pi. We can factor out of the integral an e to the ikr over r from this part. And we're left with the integral of j of x prime e to the minus ik n hat dot x prime d cubed x prime. And already you can see from this, this will be some constant integral. Well, of course, it will depend on n hat, the direction you look at. But this is an outgoing wave, outgoing spherical wave, coming out from our source to our observation points. And those fall off in amplitude like 1 over r. And the angle dependence is in this n hat. Could also write n hat means a unit vector away from, in our coordinate system, from the source, going out to some spherical polar angles. So that means we could also write A of x as some angle-dependent vector function called f of k theta phi times this outgoing spherical wave, e to the ikr over r. That's basically implied by this structure of this integral. The only non-trivial part that might change from one source to another is this fk of theta phi. Once you have that, you can find the fields. As we said, everything follows from H, so we can calculate H first by taking the curl of that expression, where we've already separated the R, theta, and phi dependences explicitly. And we're interested in this large R limit, many wavelengths away, kr much greater than 1. And using the formulas for the curl in spherical coordinates, we'll have a theta hat term that looks like e to the ikr over r times minus ik, the phi component of this angle-dependent part. And then there will be a phi hat term times the outgoing plane or spherical wave, and then ik, the theta component of the angle dependent part of that solution for A of x. And then there will be higher order terms falling off faster. This can be rewritten in a little more compact form as, no, I guess I'm leaving out. So let me give the electric field next, which, remember, was I z naught over k, curl of h, as I wrote down earlier. And again, at these large R, large distance region in the far zone, this goes to I z naught over mu naught k e to the ikr over r. And then there's a theta hat f theta of k of theta phi plus phi hat times the phi component of f of theta phi. And again, there will be higher order terms we are neglecting, which you could calculate if necessary, but the 1 over r terms are going to give the propagating radiation energy and for at large distance, so usually you won't care about the 1 over r squared terms. A few observations about this. These fields we just derived in the far zone have the following relations. H dot n hat is 0. It's a transverse electromagnetic field to this order in 1 over r, at least. It's also a transverse electric field. E dot n hat is 0. And the fields electric and magnetic are orthogonal, as we also expect for a radiation field in vacuum. So the fields transverse to the propagation axis and to each other. And they all fall off like 1 over r in the field. We can also, if sometimes you'll need higher order terms than what we've expanded, then we might have to plug in the full exponential expansion, right? E to the x 1 plus x over 1 factorial, x squared over 2 factorial, and so on inside our integral for a. We only included the first term in the Taylor expansion of the exponent of the absolute x minus x prime in the exponent. And we only kept the leading term in the denominator. We said 1 over x minus x prime is just 1 over r in the denominator. It's more important to keep that second term in the exponent. E naught over 4 pi. IKR over R. And now we can do our expansion over L, 1 over L factorial, D cubed X prime, J of X prime. And we have minus IK N hat dot X prime to the L if we keep higher order terms in the Taylor expansion of that exponential. So this kind of shows that the order of the 6Lth term, if you want to do some like quick checks, like how important are these higher order terms, they can be written in this form. They are of order kd to the lth power. Because x prime in this integral is of that order. Okay. So when you're looking at this expansion sort of concept of tackling the fields, usually, what you'll often find is you're interested in the dominant term at large R. And what you might find is calculating the lowest multiple or the second is they're vanishing. And then you'll have to find the first non-zero term. So the dominant term, when you see that word, that expression, this means usually the lowest L term that's non-zero. So if you have like a radiating quadrupole, then usually it'll be the quadrupole term that will dominate, of course, and that would usually occur if the electric dipole is zero for some reason. Okay, so let's start going through some of these lower multiples explicitly. So, of course, the very lowest term that could be there in our expansion from a mathematical point of view would be the electric monopole term. You don't normally hear people talking about electric monopole radiation. There's a reason for that. We can see that in the math. Phi of xt. Let's look at the electric potential, right? It's 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. Integral d cubed x prime. Rho of x prime. T minus r over c over r. Which goes at very large distances, capital R, goes to R, which is going to infinity at very far away from the source, goes to 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught R, integral d cubed x prime of rho of x prime, T minus R over C. What is that? This integral, it'll come up here. This is the total charge in the universe at time T minus R over C. But charge is conserved, as far as we know. So our integral just is Q, and the monopole term then will never be a monochromatically oscillating term. You can't really design within our universe a monochromatic field where the charge has that time dependence. So we conclude that a charged monopole makes static fields only. And as we know, this gives a charge monopole will give a 1 over r potential at large distance. That in turn produces 1 over r squared fields. And these do not carry energy to infinity like a radiation field. So that is not of huge interest for this discussion of radiation. The next term is, however, Time for new chalk. So, there are a lot of situations where the electric dipole radiation is, in fact, the most important. Not all, but for the visible or UV or X-rays, we are usually talking about electric dipole photons. So in the expansion, the leading order in our vector potential expansion, will be the L equals zero term. So let's analyze it. Right. It's quite simple. This factor just goes away. We just have the integral d cubed x j of x prime. And there's an identity that we talked about. I guess we even derived it back in, chapter 5, which is kind of a weird identity. It said the volume integral of one component, the ith component of ji of x prime, could also be written as the volume integral of the primed gradient of the ith component of x prime vector dotted into the full j of x. And you might remember that we did this so that we could use divergence theorem down the road. Okay. So then we would use this identity, the primed divergence of psi times the vector function A is the primed gradient of psi dotted into A plus psi times the primed divergence of A, where in this case psi, the scalar function psi in the identity, will be this ith component of the vector x prime. And of course A will be in the identity, it will be j of x prime. So that we used, I think we even used this in chapter 5, to show that this volume integral of ji of x prime can be written as this volume integral from the identity, the prime divergence of xi prime j of x prime minus xi prime, the primed divergence of j of x prime. And now we're going to do two different things with this term. First, this term, this second term, from the charge continuity equation is also minus d rho dt, which for harmonic time dependence is I omega rho. And of course, this volume integral of a divergence, we use the divergence term. This will equal integral over the surface. We can take the surface outside of the localized source. And since it's outside of the localized source, this will be zero, although this step would not vanish like for an infinitely long waveguide. You wouldn't be able to say that is zero. But let's ignore that special case. And then our identity that we've derived by this logic has recast the current density integral into a charge density integral. So again, we've assumed localized source and monochromatic. And we have this identity that comes into that first term in A, that the integral over J of X prime that's needed is just minus I omega, the integral over X prime times rho of X prime, D cubed X prime, which I thought was so important, I circled it in the notes. But I'm too lazy to circle it today. So plugging that in, we have the vector potential caused by this first term, which we will call the dipole. At an observation point x is minus I omega mu naught over 4 pi. The electric dipole moment associated with the spatial part of the charge density, e to the ik r over r, right? Because this is exactly what we define in chapter 4 as the electric dipole moment. Okay, that's a pretty important formula. From that, we can calculate the fields. It's just a matter of taking some curls, curl of psi times a vector p. Is this identity? You can look up in Jackson, J gradient of psi crossed into p, plus psi times the curl of p. Here p is a constant, so this term is of course zero. And so our H field, our magnetic field, is 1 over mu naught curl of A is, works out to be minus IKC over 4 pi, the gradient of e to the ikr over r, crossed into p. That gradient will produce a term going like 1 over r and a term going 1 over r squared when you take the radial derivatives. And we are interested in the radiation zone So the 1 over r squared terms I'm not going to bother with, although it's in the notes if you really care about it. So the dominant term at infinity of the magnetic field works out to be ck squared over 4 pi n hat crossed into the electric dipole moment of your oscillating charge distribution, then your expected spherical wave coming out from that, and then there will be terms I'm not going to write of order 1 over r squared that are not really contributing to the radiation at infinity. And this is an approximation you often will want to make when you're working with radiation fields. When you see a gradient acting on the fields, in particular acting on e to the ikr, you can realize that this will equal ikr hat times e to the ikr. It'll be a constant at infinity, and you'll usually neglect, we aren't interested in the 1 over r term from the radial derivative, from the angular derivative, I should say, of that, you would get that would be divided by r. So in fact, yeah, only the radial derivative of e to the ikr itself is usually what will survive. We'll also need the electric field in the radiation zone. This formula you'll use a lot in this chapter. E is IZ naught over K, curl of H, and this is then minus Z naught N hat cross H plus order of 1 over R squared. And so E at infinity, the dominant term, is C Z naught K squared over 4 pi N hat cross P crossed into N hat times E to the IKR over R. And again, C Z naught is also 1 over epsilon naught. So usually what you are the most interested in is the time average radiated power. So let's work that out. We've got E and H. We can find our pointing vector. We have complex fields, so we know how to take the time average. Time average of S will be half the real part of E cross conjugate of H. Clearly, this will go like 1 over r squared at infinity. And what you're often interested in is not only the magnitude of this totally, but also the angular distribution. At what angles are you getting all your power? Okay, so let's calculate the angular distribution of the radiated power. Which is usually given this symbol, the differential power radiated, differential in solid angle, dP d omega. So the energy per second per unit steradian. This is defined to be at the large R limit, R squared, n hat dotted into the time averaged pointing vector, which is the real part of c squared, there's the 1/2, k to the fourth, z naught, impedance of free space, over 16 pi squared, and then this weird vector quantity, n hat cross p hat cross n hat, crossed into n hat cross p conjugate, all that full wacky vector dotted into n hat. Now I go through the simplification in the notes, how to simplify this term. Right, things like the back cab rule applied over and over again. But let me just give the specialized case when the dipole moment of the spatial part of the charge density is real, and we can call n hat dot p cos theta, cosine of a real angle. This won't always be true, like for circular polarization. But when you have a real electric dipole moment, then the geometry simplifies to the absolute value of n cross p squared as sine squared theta. And dp d omega is proportional to that. And this might be, if you had to pick one formula that's the most important that you might use for the rest of your life from this chapter, it might be this one. C squared, z naught, k to the fourth over 32 pi squared, the magnitude of p squared, sine squared theta. For the power radiated from an oscillating dipole, right, it's going to be peaking at 90 degrees from the angle of the dipole. But don't forget, it's only for a real. And if you have, for instance, a rotating dipole, this formula is not valid. You have to come back to the defining equation to work it out. And the last quantity I think I'll close with today is the total power radiated, which you get by integrating that, which is also maybe the also one of the crucial formulas of this chapter. Total power radiated is, of course, the integral of dp d omega over all solid angles. This integral works out, since I'm out of time, I'll just not do the integral. You have to do the integral of sine cube theta d theta. It's the only non-trivial integral, which is 4/3. And we have z c squared k to the 4th over 12 pi magnitude of p squared, again, for real dipole moments. Okay. We'll apply this to an antenna radiating next time. That's all for today. And I went over 2 minutes, and I'm sorry.